opinion of the House Health and Social Services Committee will not come to order. It is now 3:10 p.m. Thursday, April 15, 2021, here in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Kretzky, co-chair, Representative Sparkles, Representative McCarty, Representative Parks, Representative Kirka, and Representative Fields just moved in and sat down to join us. I would like to thank our health record staff, Martha Moore, and our staff, Kelsey Riker, for moderating today's meeting and making this meeting possible. With the record effect that we have a quorum to conduct business, please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Otherwise, Representative McCarty has said he will still have cameras raising up. Thank you. We have multiple items on the agenda today, and the following order will hold a public testimony for HB 168, introduced by myself, Representative. Then, if it is the will of the committee, we will take final action on HB 168, and Senate Bill 21 by Senator Reback. Next up, we'll have an initial hearing and public testimony on HB 105, detention buyers by request of the governor. And lastly, we will hold an initial hearing and public testimony on HB 58 by Representative Collier. As a reminder, we are going to continue holding over HB 103, and the amendment deadline has been extended to Wednesday, 4/21. To make the most of our time, we would please hold our questions until after invited testimony, and then after questions, we will open up public testimony for individual pieces of legislation. So, as promised, our first order of business is HB 168, the current application for state benefits. A little bit of an update since it was introduced on Tuesday. We did receive and forwarded on to the committee that day a zero fiscal note for HB 168 that we sent out yesterday. But we do have Jason Burke from DHFS on the line, I believe. Yes, okay. To answer any questions about that fiscal note. Do we have any questions about that or anything else with 168 before we open up for public testimony?
Discussion as to why which it that perhaps one of the words of needy or the language of food stamp program and federal guidelines to the change of language, does that mean it changed to us as well?
Thank you for that, and I should have mentioned that on topic. So we had a conversation, I believe, with Representative Cox's office. Our office also reached out and spoke with Health and Life Legal. And we put in an initial request to change the needy and the food stamps, but then we were alerted that if we do that, then we, in this bill, right now, just the section that we're dealing with, we are not creating inconsistencies across a lot of individual sections. And the recommendation was that we pursue that separate piece of legislation. And I am happy to pursue that, and if that's Philip Simmons' bill to the legal room with that, I think it's a worthy avenue, but we took the advice of not creating any consistency with this piece of legislation. I think it was a well taken point on Tuesday. Do you still have Jason Burke on the line? I'm not seeing anyone on the line except for that. Okay. I will now close public testimony. Do we have any additional questions or comments coming to you regarding this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Although it's not reflected in the report, I think that we were targeting providing this opportunity, providing this is what's being done on paper. The baseline thing that is more easy to be found at the options, being able to apply for necessary supports online, provides a better opportunity for access and any authority support in the first region.
Thank you. Bojan Zlokowski, do I have a motion to move this bill to committee?
Legislator Anderson report House Bill 1-6-3-9-X-1-W out of committee with individual recommendations in the Cash Risk Club.
Is there any objection?
Seeing that, House Bill 168 passes from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal vote. We will take up both items to complete our paperwork.
Our next order of business is taking final action on SB 21 license renewal with Healthcare Paramedics by Senator Rebeck. We have Brian Webb, Emergency Response Manager, who is on the phone for any questions that you may have.
Any other questions from the committee?
The sponsor's office.
I believe Mr. Duggan
is here in the room to take help.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for giving my name to the SB 21 order. We also referred to our committee on Article 35. Is that the companion bill to this piece of legislation?
Is that for the record? Stopping staff journalizing or recognizing that other problems?
Yes, I passed on our committee. I also received House Bill 35 that was presented by Representative Shalom with the same.
Yes.
Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Duggan or for Brian Webb on the phone? I wanted to also just remind folks on the record, we're here as because I wanted to say that I didn't say on the radio and take public testimony, and we have this statement on zero fiscal impact. So, no more questions. Co-Chair Zlokowski, can I have a motion to move this bill from committee?
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 21, motion to revise LS020-E out of committee with individual recommendations and attached to the
amendment. Any objections? Seeing none, SB 21 passes from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal vote.
For Andrew's successor, Eric did a measurable facility. Eric has provided staff and other functions identified 7 notes and a magic 18 of only held and their facility statewide. The second project has been led to the fall thus with the limited circumstances. The non-believable members might have helped to allow their secure juvenile justice facilities under another placement that they lost completely. These situations are very well, the general law of minor criminal custody and the Office of Social Services, and push all of that for placement and the proposal for a dangerous situation. In most situations, the Office of Social Services takes court findings under 47-10-141, allowing those who have been held securely for a short period of time and if they're serving along the most So the new federal judge at EPI expands the court findings that are necessary before those lawyers may be detained, and then it further limits the duration of the secure building. As mentioned, those cases are valid while during the last 3 fiscal years, there's been a total of 3 years that have been held in this manner each year. And I also want to just want to give appreciation for the governor's involvement in the support of the legislation for the division and the cooperation of the Department of Corrections, Public Safety, and Law on the development of this proposal. Thank you for your time and support today. I'm happy to answer any questions now or after that, but I have some questions. Because that's, excuse me, the to enter into an agreement with the Department of Services for the holding of land grounds in DDG facilities. Sections 2 and 3 relate to the holding of land and equipment we call flash offenders in DDG facilities. Again, those are the rare instances usually used in OCS custody. Sections 4 and 5 address DJJ jurisdiction and applicability. Sections are basically fairly changes to allow for the holding of land minors in DJJ custody. Section 6 and 7 make fairly changes to our other waiver statute, that's Section 6. Section 7 is what we call the discretionary waiver statute. Those are the two ways in which waivers may be made into the adult correctional system. Section 8 is a new section of the juvenile statute that is really the core of the main matter of the bill. And what that section does is explain that DMC will enter an agreement with DJJ, and the DJJ will hold these matters until age 18, and then the latter part of that section explains that the exceptions that are allowed in the Federal Act and the DPA for when DJJ may not hold the agreements of these land grounds and facilities until age 18. Section 9 is adding land grounds to an appearance to the residual and parental rights and responsibility section that currently exists for delinquent minors who are in DJJ custody. Section 10 makes conforming changes to our dual sentencing statute. Section 11, 12, and 13 make conforming changes to our arrest, holding, and detention statute to recognize that we want these land matters to be held in DJJ custody and transported to DJJ facilities in the same manner as other delinquents. Sections 14 and 15 deal with the confidentiality statute for DJJ include this information. DJJ will treat this information in the same confidential manner as all the other confidential information. Section 16 is the repeal clause. There's a couple of sections that are no longer needed in DJJ. Statute. You have an applicability clause to basically say that any minors who are in DMC custody who are still doesn't affect when contact would be transferred to DJJ custody. Section 18 is the revised clause that deals with the executive order that's since been rescinded by the governor. And Section 19 is the effective date, which is set for July 1st of this year to keep this department in compliance with the deadlines for the Federal Act.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Do we have any questions from the committee?
Okay. Thank you. For the chair, two-part question here. First part is, only 18-year-olds are currently in DJJ facilities. And the second part is, only minors are currently in DMC facilities.
Through the chair, Representative McCoy, I don't know how many 18-year-olds are in DJJ facilities today. We can certainly get that number for you, because I'm sure you can make it clear that for delinquent youth, DJJ has the authority to have supervision and custody of those youth couples with a lead capability. So there are also 18-year-olds in our DJJ detention and trigger facilities that are under the delinquency statutes, not under the And then the numbers that were provided to the body of the reflections today, that were 7 minors in data services respectively.
The question, the answer to the question we got in the proposal, Section 8 of the bill talks about transferring minors who are 18 years old to the Department of Corrections, custody age 18. That only applies to waived minors. So the minors have been waived into the adult system. they will not be transferring any delinquent minors of age 18 to the Department of Corrections. They are held under different statutes. And I want to note that the last meeting before the House and the Senate, the Health and Social Services Committee, certainly saw that same issue. There was a lack of clarity in the committee. And the Senate Committee, Health and Social Services Committee, adopted a committee substitute with their suggestions to provide for the clarity on Section 8 and really show that we're only talking about waiting minors in Section 8. And the rules that are delineated there only apply to this new class of minors that are going to be part of the DJJ facility for a temporary period.
Thank you for the sound of this forum. Then, is that going to change the number of 18-year-olds? Because you said that you can hold them until 19, so is that going to shift that you will not be able to hold anyone that turns 18?
For the record, first of all, I'm Director of Administrative Justice to the Town, no, it will not change that. I've been with the Twitter Census Reform, they're trying to make a little bit more clear as well. Under the new census statutes, where that are filed in 4712, we will still have the ability to have jurisdiction of those juveniles, potential records on the right to vote, but that will not change.
So does that have a differentiation of the threats to the 18-year-old that could potentially go to DJJ or could go to a DOC
facility? Yes, there are different fences. The statute for automatic waiver offenses is for a minor, so it's 16 years or older at the time of the offense. The majority fall under the section that references if those children committed an act of violence or family crime against the person or also in the first degree, they're added to waiver cases. So, for instance, if 15-year-old committed one of those offenses, they would actually be subject to the jurisdiction of the Department of Juvenile Justice under 4712, not automatic waiver offenses.
Thanks for the chair. I was just hoping that the Department of Justice or teachers may be able to find members.
Okay. Any other questions?
In the House Judiciary Committee, two amendments were adopted. The First Amendment cleared the error in Section 2 that, or Section 3 rather, but not in reference to delinquency in the child protection statute. So that was an existing erroneous reference in that child protection statute that mentioned delinquency counts 47-50. We're just taking the opportunity to fix that in this bill. That section of statute of child protection only deals with families. It doesn't deal with the arrest of delinquent minors, which is 47-12. So that was one of the fixes. The other fix in the House Judiciary Committee was an attempt to clarify in Section 8 that we're only talking about in that section waiting minors. Minors who are subject to the auto waiver under 47-12-0-0 or 47-12-100, the discretionary waiver. I would say that that was personally successful, and the Senate Health and Services Committee went further with actually defining the term waiting minor for the purposes of that section to really clarify. We're not changing anything about how delinquent minors are held. This bill is focused on this new class of minors that the division will be responsible for between their 16th and 18th birthdays potentially, if they are waived into the adult system.
I just want to note that, for the record, because we also have Sydney Wood, the director of the Division of Institutions, Department of Corrections.
So, available
for questions. Is that any
other questions or
thoughts?
Housing
costs.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm just trying to make sure we understand the net effect. I believe it is in such a minor thing you're subject to about court. Are apparently entitled to a hearing every 30 days to determine whether they should be continued to be held in adult facilities. And I can't remember exactly where that, what page number that was on, but they've given me the as far as how this works, in the fiscal room, my initial thought was that it was going to require a considerable increase in expense in the court system, but we're just talking about half a dozen individuals per year. I suppose that's not a big deal, but could you explain that a little bit?
Okay, thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
research is so concerned, I wrongly and subjectively, is that someone's opinion rather than something that's already established in place of these criteria? Do you understand the question?
Pretty sure I won't pretend to put it. I think that it's not so. We don't have exactly what the board is supposed to figure out with all that. We don't have an MOU exactly prepared that we can cover questions, but that version for this as to work through is that we won't have protocols in place with the National General Justice data. We have mental health clinicians that are assigned to each of our facilities. Like the mental health clinician has been working with the general justice officers and the letter nursing staff and other direct treatments to try to help that youth manage the behavioral unit, and they haven't been successful. But there will be a process by which they would need to bring that up through and get approvals before they would go to the court and just arbitrarily ask for that youth to be
last follow-up here. Thank you for the chair. As I encourage that there is that process and looking forward to hearing about that so that it's objectively evaluated and we're not hearing it from youth and accusations that were rightfully moving youth. Thank you.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. To the chair, that's the follow-up to the party's question. I was reading through Section 8, and it looked like there's a list of the criteria, things for a judge to consider when determining what kind of facility on pages 8, starting line 1. And there's different categories of things to consider, but those seem pretty subjective to me. Yeah, so I guess in reference to the director's answer, was it a different statute you're referring to? What are the statutes you're referring to where there will be things on the list?
Maybe it's not up here, but that would be a best particular, that would be the best statute that the court would be to follow to make that, to make those filings to say that it would be a good the transfer to a dancing facility. What I was referencing was internal protocols that we would put in place at the Division of General Justice to make sure that there were those internal improvements from, a facility later comes to, executive leadership and says, we just don't believe that this year the facility to be best managed at a Division of facility, and we want to reach out to the Department of Law to seek a transfer to a dancing facility. So I was referencing internal protocols, but that's not part of Section 8. That does come out of the federal judge ID preliminary bills, circumstances under which the judge needs a secondary consideration for the decision.
Yes, I guess it's a good follow-up. So it sounds like the process you have in mind, while it follows this category according to guidelines, it does remain subjective in terms of the general standard or clarity of. And maybe that's one of those things that kind of has to be subjective. It has to be observed by individual in terms of the judge and the officers and the criminal justice folks. Is that something that you think is necessary to have a subjective like that? Or do you think what clarifying language would be appropriate?
I think that the word is sufficiently different. That's important to have. I think it's also important to recognize. I believe it was in the Data Committee substitute bill that we also work with the Public Defender Agency to also recognize that in those situations, especially for those post-conviction youth, that they would still be represented by the Public Defender Agency so that they would have legal counsel available to them when, the civil justice is coming forward to
actually become Elmer was a just a birthday album, which we 58 as well.
I'm just waiting.
You're welcome to go with your box if you'd like.
Thank you, Eric Snyder. The object of the ban of this bill is to reduce the incidence of juveniles being held in adult facilities. So, will there be much of a change in lifestyle? I would guess that there aren't separate facilities in many of the smaller communities that may have adult facilities. Are we going to have to do something to make more juvenile facilities available?
Thank you.
countries like this coverage. Thanks for having a little assistance. It's a deviation. I'm sure that that will find a way of claiming that those cheapest tobacco students will be presenting the bill. And finally, the panelists will be on the phone for questions. The board in the room, we have Director Lauren Windheim, Division of Insurance, Director Nathan Hart, Division of Healthcare Services, and Dr. Tina Thompson, the retired OBGYN. Again, we continue with our trend of holding questions until the end of the presentation. Everyone, please, would you please put yourself on the record and reading your presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On behalf of the members of the committee for the Rocky Mountain Rose Red, I'm the State Representative for Health District for the honor of last night. I also want to thank you for hearing Hospital 58. Since the 1990s, chronic education required health insurance bills regulated by the state to provide coverage for both prescription drugs and devices to also cover prescription contraceptives. Federal law and the provision of the Affordable Care Act on Canada expanded on these state policies in several ways. The ACA's contraceptive coverage guarantee stems from Section 2713 of the Public Health Service Act, which requires non-mandatory health insurance coverage in employer-sponsored group health plans to cover preventive services without cost sharing. Section 2713 requires coverage in limits for preventive services as defined by the Health Resources and Services Administration. HRSAS, the Institute of Medicine, to recommend a limit to preventive services that should be covered. Based on this recommendation, HRSA defined limits preventive services to include all contraceptives approved by the FDA, sterilization procedures, physician education, and counseling for women, and reproductive capacity as prescribed by a healthcare provider. Collectively referred to as contraceptive services. The final provider services rules issued required insurers and group health plans to cover all such contraceptive services. Recognizing that several religions object to contraceptive coverage, however, the federal government issued rules that excluded religious employers from the contraceptive coverage guarantee. More recently, some states have amended and expanded their own requirements to match the federal guarantee. Some of the state provisions go beyond the federal guarantee. For example, some states have ensured that women would receive an extended supply of a method at one time, usually a 12-month supply rather than a difficult one or a 3-month supply. As Bill 58 puts into effect the statutes, language that is consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. We also made the experiment to dispensing up to 12 months of prescription contraceptives at a time. I'll ask you to often face numerous challenges when trying to access prescriptive contraceptives. It's hard for women, especially in rural areas, and multiple trips a year to the pharmacy can be an intermittent barrier in accessing consistent contraception. And then in many of the problems is many women in balancing their personal health and work and family life. Research featured in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. An article in reproductive shows that women who are dismissed are prevalent to prevent contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancy and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortion that women dispense their 1 to 2 month supply. Hospital 58 also sends women to the state. They are reviewing the prior version of this legislation by office sponsored in a previous legislative session. The Department of Health and Social Services has been on this year at a $1.35 million savings. Women in my family support Hospital 58, and that tells me a lot. It's worth it not only because it is often time consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraceptive every 3 months or, in some cases, every month. They also support it because they know that improved access to contraceptives means improved health for women and families. Hospital 58 also has an initial benefit that helps protect victims of domestic violence. Over the past few years, there has been an increased awareness in Alaska on the national level of the issue of domestic violence and sexual assault. Movements such as Me Too and Times Up have shown that we need to do more as a society to support those that have experienced and are currently experiencing this type of violence. We've learned about the issue of reproductive coercion, also known as contraceptive coercion, a form of domestic or interpersonal violence used by abusers. The National Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault advocates and those that have experienced explained that through stories about contraceptive coercion in which abusers took a plan on their contraceptives and did not have access to the means of gaining power and control. Research from 2011 National Intimate Partner in Sexual Violence Survey shows that around 9% of U.S. men report having an intimate partner who tried to get their credit and they did not want to or refuse to use a condom. This disregarding women's health and autonomy is inexcusable. By providing consumers with coordinated supply of birth control methods, including long-acting reversible contraception, Hospital 58 critically supports victims and survivors by assisting those who are attempting to limit syphilis, possible in the short term, and then report longer-term safety. Supported by a strong, long-standing body of evidence, contraceptive services have long been recognized to include government bodies wide range of private sector experts as a vital and effective component of preventive and public health care. Contraceptive use helps women avoid unintended pregnancy and improve birth control, which in turn will have substantial positive consequences for infants, women, families, and society. Moreover, although costly and daunting bargaining to effective contraceptive use on the part of individual women, government struggles to grant that insurance coverage of contraceptive services and supplies without cost sharing is a low cost and even cost saving means of helping women overcome this obstacle. Hospital 58 makes funds for lasting women and families, and with that, I'll turn it over to my staff, Ms. Jimmons, to explain the details of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Coleman. Ms. Jimmons, please be prepared to talk for the record.
Thank you, members of the committee for the record. My name is Lindsay Jones. I'm staff to Representative Coleman. Thank you for your attention to the meeting today. As Representative Coleman mentioned, our hospital usually puts a lot of patients on which it is consistent with the standards set by the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. This policy also requires health insurance providers to offer a consumer, provide coverage for a 12-month supply of contraceptives on their credit, and provide reimbursement to the health care provider or dispensing entity. Section 1 of the bill lays this out. Section 1 also gives health care insurers the ability to enact reasonable cost containment measures and prevents an insurer from offsetting the costs of compliance. In subsection A, cost containment is defined as incentivizing the use of generic or lower cost medications, or the use of healthcare providers or pharmacies that offer services or prescriptions at a lower rate. The inclusion of this language gives insurers the ability to steer towards generics as a cost containment strategy, and this is a proposal that the Department of Administration had previously advocated and for substantially reduce their costs in over a 12-month supply of birth control. However, subsection F states if the covered therapeutically equivalent version of is not available or is considered medically inadvisable by the health care provider or the insurer, the health care provider, shall provide coverage without cost sharing for an alternative therapeutically equivalent version of the prescription contraceptive. The inclusion of this language establishes that even though insurers are able to steer towards generics, if a particular generic brand is determined not medically appropriate, then the insurer must accommodate the insured. Finally, Section 8 of Section 1 includes a religious exemption, so health plans sponsored by certain exempt religious employers are not subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 2 amends AS 10-200 by adding a provision applying to home rule municipalities. Section 3 amends AS 2920 by adding a new section clarifying that municipal health insurance claims are self-insured or subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 4 amends AS 3090I, which relates to policies of group insurance covering state employees, by adding a new subsection covering professional group health insurance policies covering employees in a participating governmental unit. Section 5 amends AS 3090I, which relates to self-insurance and excess loss insurance by adding a language to capture a self-insured group medical plan covering active state employees. That's all to say that Section 4 and 5 clarify the requirements of Section 1 and the bill applied to active state employees.
Social Services to amend and submit for federal approval a state plan for medical expenses covered consistent with Section 6. Section 8 is an additional effect of Section 6 level and Section 9 pertains to the effective dates. I was asked to provide a discussion of changes to the section because, since the first draft of this committee in 2017, I need to be in those medical initiatives. Again, this commits to our forthcoming. During the executive legislative session, multiple changes were related to this legislation. First, the Services of Infrastructure Services Committee adopted a committee substitute that made changes to the bill based on recommendations by the Department of Administration and the Department of Forest, Community, and Economic Development. These changes did help to recover the state that need to act on reasonable costs to contain their measures, as we discussed in Section 1. And make certain that the bill comes after state employees, as we discussed in Section 4 and 5. Second, the House Finance Committee adopted an amendment to clarify that municipalities who are self-insured are also captured under this bill and must cover a total of 5% piece, as we discussed in the countries. Third, two amendments were adopted in the House Senate. The first changed the effective date to update it. And the second amendment, the existing religious exemption in our bill to create a narrower religious exemption to funds that the coverage is currently provided under federal law. During the 31st legislative session, no significant change was made to the bill. In the redacting process, our office amended the legislation after receiving feedback about the right from the sterilization. The federal guarantee does not require similar coverage for epithectomy or male condoms. Upon research, we know that constants can require coverage of male sterilization. Therefore, we amended the bill to add the final language so that higher deductible plans can apply the policy deductible to adult male sterilization benefits so that enrollees and students can maintain their health savings account eligibility. And before we go to questions, the link for the committee. Thank you.
Explain the rationale for this not being not in the scope of the prescription.
is my whole founder's meeting to other sites.
And I'm sure there are. I don't know. Subjections.
Thank you.
reduce the need for abortion tests and improve the lives of Alaskans across the state. During the pandemic, when people lost their jobs and no longer had access to insurance, they may use the tool of birth control, whatever way.
Thank you. Yeah.
And this bill has nothing to do with the availability of known medication or pharmacy pickup. I've heard from a number of concerns that weren't able to get their medication and the troubles of weaknesses. This doesn't resolve that issue. That's just a logistical thing of pharmacy management, is that correct?
The
money are we talking about?
Potentially be able to lessen negative symptoms, and one of the most important things that we can do
to help support families as we work from their lives and get under distress and reduce damages and neglect, and also bring more economic independence and stability for folks without having the ability to control things that they can see and how they don't. And while probably in terms of outcomes for people that need to control them and have their prescriptions, but we're just having to really grab people who save money because it's a lot more expensive to have a baby, but it is incredibly expensive. We've heard recently about there's more money for the family members who've been in insecurity and things like this. It's very expensive to have a baby. It's not nearly as expensive to prevent a child that feels an intent on having in the first place. Because our policy is more cynical for your mothers, different leaders.
Coach Arnold-Sobeski.
Some external music in the world.
So, if that's fine, I don't see any reason why
Services.